Chapter 7. Hempstead, Texas, 1970. The girl couldn't risk being seen on the open country road, so she crossed the tree-heavy pastures and threaded the fences that divided them, spring-loaded grasshoppers bouncing away from her ankles. All around her, cicadas thrummed in harsh staccato, sounding like hard rain on a tin roof. Woozy with lack of food and drink, she swayed and propped herself against a young pecan tree until her blood made its slow crawl back to her brain. She knew now not to ignore the rattle of true hunger and pushed steadily through the grass toward the gas station sign in the distance. Forced to approach the road to get to the station's entrance, and she hoped food, she heard the rumble of an eastbound car. When she saw it was police, she squatted low, head tucked, arms hugging her bony shins. Her heartbeat slowed and her mind stilled, and she stayed this way long after the car had passed. Someone like her wouldn't last long on the lam. She could hear the crackly APB now. Unaccompanied minor. Says she's 13 years of age, but doesn't look more than 10. Possibly of Mexican descent. Possibly in need of medical attention. All units be advised. Like most kids, she had picked up the lingo from watching Dragnet. Unlike most kids, she had also learned it from the backseats of cop cars. Every other time she had tried to escape her foster homes, she had been caught. Not today. Today, she was going to meet Eleanor. The girl had first heard of her great-aunt Eleanor a few months ago when one of the social workers, a perpetually stressed, coffee-scented woman named Barb, had mentioned to her foster parents, the Mashers, that she had just found a note in her case file about a relative, her birth mother's aunt, named Eleanor, who lived in a town called Pecan Hollow. Barb said they had tried to reach her when Kit was an infant, but for some reason or another, it hadn't worked out. The girl had tried to punch the social worker for not telling her sooner, as if she hadn't been wishing for something like this her entire life. The Mashers had had to hold her down and nearly stuffed a chill pill between her clenched teeth. If the girl had been a gentler child, if she had asked nicely, maybe she could have gotten more information out of the beleaguered and cross social worker. But by the time she finally settled herself down, Barb was packing her bag to go. The girl had begged the social worker to put her in touch with the aunt. A phone number, a last name. But she sighed and shrugged. And though Barb said she would look into it, Kit knew from the look in her eyes, like she had already moved on to her next appointment, that this woman would do no such thing. She trudged out of the house, her monstrous briefcase slapping against her calf. Why the great aunt hadn't claimed her, the girl didn't know. Sometimes she got angry at Eleanor, thinking of the bastards and idiots she'd been entrusted to. People who oughtn't be allowed to care for animals, let alone children. She worried if she found Aunt Eleanor, she might be so wicked to her aunt that she'd get kicked out before she had a chance to prove she was worth keeping. She supposed it was an awful lot of trouble to take in a child. But now that she was 13, she could help take care of her aunt. Sometimes she let herself look forward to the day they would meet. Maybe Eleanor flicked her earlobe when she was nervous too. Maybe she also hated candy. Maybe, for once, the girl could see her features in someone else's face. By the time she reached the filling station, it had been a day and a half since her last meal, and she trembled with hunger. She kept cover behind a staked panel of particle board that read, "Dirt for sale," and watched. A guy with gray skin and suspenders sat behind the counter, smoking and chatting with a local, while a city man in a maroon suit stood in line, jittering with impatience and too much caffeine. Outside, a glossy station wagon refueled. A friendly-looking dad with bushy sideburns manning the pump. Three kids, covered in snacks, chattered and tugged at each other in the way back, while their pretty mom with Patty Duke hair stood outside the car stretching her legs. At once, frightened and rapt, the girl watched them as if they were a strange species. They had the most beautiful peachy skin, smooth and even, like it was painted on. No spider veins or sores, no bruising or asthmatic flaking, no dimpled flap. Nothing like the decaying people she had known. Mom strutted around behind Dad, laced her fingers in front of his soft paunch, and squeezed. Dad turned quickly and scooped Mom up, and she laughed, the kids joining her with peals of mock disgust. The girl felt flush on her cheeks and neck, a deep throbbing in her chest. She turned away, confused, the brief spell of wonderment eclipsed by such longing. The diesel engine started and the wagon lumbered onto the feeder road and disappeared on the horizon. The girl sat and sobbed, overcome by the beauty of what she'd seen and the searing bitterness that she would never know it from the inside. Though it had been just seconds, she despaired to see the family go. She reached in her pocket for the note, the only possession she had ever cared about. Folded in quarters and protected by a sandwich baggie, it gave her a prick of something sweet and tender just from being touched. Though she opened it only rarely, she knew its message by heart and chanted it like the rosary. Sensing self-pity, she withdrew her hand and scrubbed away the tears with her sleeve. Quit now. Quit your bawling. A numbness spread from her belly outward, until she felt only a faint buzzing, an airiness more tolerable than the shock of emotion from before. She thumbed her eye sockets until she saw spots and refocused on her plan. If she could get enough to eat and sock some food away in her backpack, she might just make it to Pecan Hollow. Squatting there, watchful and still, she waited until the customers left and the cashier had gone to the bathroom. She dashed inside, snatched a bag of sunflower seeds and one of pork rinds and stuffed them into her tucked-in shirt. She could hear the lazy stutter of urine and made a run for drinks, an icy lemony soda and a bottle of Coke. When the faucet began to run, she snagged another bag of pork rinds for good measure and headed for the door, high on the promise of a solid meal. Just then, the animal rumble of a Mustang approached, and the car idled and then stopped. The girl huddled behind the magazine display and peeked out, eyes fixed on the man who got out of the black car. He was unlike anyone she had ever seen, more action hero than man. He was strong and wore clothes meant to be noticed. A tight, patterned shirt unbuttoned to the middle of his smooth chest, slim jeans that flared at the bottom and swung when he walked. She marveled at the creamy brown leather of his skin, the molded cut of his muscles, the slick, dark hair that flipped out at the nape of his neck. The foster fathers had been fleshy and sedentary, or cigarette skinny and nervous. This man moved surely, fluidly, like a hunter. The icy crackle of his blue eyes seemed to produce a light of their own. The doorknob to the bathroom turned and snapped her attention back to escape. She hustled outside and around the corner, narrowly eluding detection by the cashier. She was in range of the man with the Mustang, whose back was turned only briefly to select his fuel. Flush against the building, she froze and scanned the terrain for others. When she looked back, the man was gone. She had to move now. Shirt stuffed, drinks in hands, she shuffled toward her spot behind the sign as quietly as she could without crinkling her spoils. As she passed the Mustang, she saw on the dash a white paper fast food bag, its top folded neatly like that of a fresh order. Her stomach began to grind, and she knew if she had a chance at nabbing it, she would have to act fast. The driver's side window was two-thirds down. She looked around, still no one, and ran. The handle wouldn't budge. So she one-armed the drinks, hoisted herself halfway through the window, and grabbed the bag. She could smell the starchy French fries, the beef patty, the tang of mustard. Wriggling back, she clamped the bag tight between her teeth, feet groping for the pavement.
"Hi, what do you think you're doing there?"
someone said behind her. The cashier, she thought. She would need to let go of everything and run if she was going to get away. She dropped the drinks and pushed back, the bags of crushed pork rinds and sunflower seeds now slipping out of her shirt, the drive-thru bag still in her mouth. A strong arm belted her waist and lifted her high. She flailed, kicking and cussing between bared teeth, never letting go of the bag. His grip tightened, and he clutched her close. She writhed and clawed, taking skin and hair. He managed to pin her arms down so that she could only thrash like a fish until at last her strength waned and she stopped, panting and twitchy.
"Everything okay, mister?"
an older voice said.
"She's all right. Just a little lost, I think," said the man, who was holding her like a bundle of loose sticks.
And he turned so that she was face to face with the cashier. If that was the cashier, then who had caught her? She looked down and determined that the arms around her were those of the Mustang's owner. Her heart sank as she felt the concrete strength in his grip and realized she might not get out of this. She began to worry about the next placement and hoped to death they just sent her to juvie.
"I'll make sure she gets home," the man said,
his voice smooth and near.
"Okay, well, I don't ask questions and I don't want no trouble," the cashier said and wiped his forehead with a yellow chamois. "If you're gonna call the authorities, make sure you do it somewhere else. People don't like to see cop cars. They'll just go to the station across the road and keep going there."
"Understood, sir. Thank you much.
I'll take care of it."
The cashier, agitated now by his own discourse, went on.
"Won't matter how much I lower my prices, and I do have a bottom line, mind you. My prices are fair, but I do have a bottom line. But the minute someone sees trouble, they pay a premium to stay out of it."
"We'd better mosey then, mister," the man said, marking the end of the conversation with a hard smile. The cashier finally took his cue and walked away, muttering and dabbing at his neck with the chamois. The action hero man opened the passenger door and set the girl down. She could run now, but she was too feeble to go very far. If they were sending her back, she would like to eat first. She opened the bag, which she had managed to keep between her teeth through it all. But except for a wad of greasy wrapping papers, a fries carton, and a handful of unused condiments, It was empty. Too weak to scream or cry, now mourning the lost bags of rinds and seeds outside the car, she collapsed on the seat. With quivering hands, she attempted to open a packet of mayonnaise.
"Sweetheart," the man said, "you're starving."
She could not even muster the strength to look at him and was so fatigued she took pleasure in not moving for a moment. The man smelled of lemon drops and bread. Even he made her hungry. She closed her eyes. Something touched her lips. A straw.
"Drink now," he said.
She sipped. Cherry cola. Caramel sweetness. Effervescent and chilled. She sputtered, coughed, and drank again, stronger already as the sugar slid into her bloodstream.
"This'll hold you until we get you some real food."
He got in the driver's seat, keyed the ignition, and squealed into a sharp turn.
"You know, if you were so hungry," he said,
and looked at her like he was trying to figure her out,
"all you had to do was ask."
Chapter 8. The girl worried her earlobe with her thumb in the brightly lit cafe as they waited for lunch. The effect of the sugar had crested and was now fading, soon to drop her like a junk car from a crane. He had ordered a feast, the promise of which, coupled with the time it took to arrive, had her both anxious and flaccid in an attempt to conserve energy. Not accustomed to such generosity, she tried to assess the extent to which he was fucking with her. She had seen the faces of snaggle-toothed boys and girls pasted to telephone poles, heard the safety mantras in school. On the surface, she was not in a favorable situation, yet it seemed less worrisome than many others she had known. It was difficult to see this man as a real threat. He had been friendly on the drive over here, though she had been too tired to answer him back or say anything for herself. Maybe it was the way he had brushed the crumbs off her seat before she sat down, or how he decrusted the ketchup bottle with a damp napkin. How bad could he be if he tended to such details? He looked at her now in an unfamiliar way, searching and curious. She scorched under the light of his attention. Just as the girl was about to crunch on another packet of sugar, the waitress brought a large tray of burgers, fries, and sodas. She transferred them to the table one by one. The girl, who seconds before had felt nothing but the dry hollow of deep hunger, sprang to life with appetite. She reached for the oozing cheeseburger in front of her, but the man swiftly pinned her hand to the table. The perfect aroma wafted around, torturing her. She nearly passed out with disappointment.
"I know you're hungry, but let's be civil and introduce ourselves, little miss."
He released her hand.
"I'm Manny Romero. What's your name?"
"My name?" she said, searching for an answer. The policeman who had found her as an infant had supposedly named her Catherine, but the only time she heard her name spoken was when a teacher called roll or a social worker handed her off to a new foster family. It was official and girly and nothing to do with her. The Motchers had called her Bug, and the other families had put their own spins on her name, all of which she hated. It struck her, now, as a chance to give herself something more fitting. Nothing came to mind. The silence began to embarrass her.
"Well, you must be called something," Manny said,
rolling the teal cuffs of his sleeves to his elbows. She stared at the meat of his forearms, wondering what it must feel like to be that strong.
"If you don't tell me, I'll have to name you myself."
Then it came to her. A name she had heard at school, maybe, whose she couldn't recall. Short and sharp, neither male nor female. Easy to say, easy to forget. She reached out her grubby hand, and he shook it. "I'm Kit."
"Good to know you, Kit," he said,
with a smile that softened the hunch in her shoulders. Kit. She could live with that. He released her hand and gestured to the gorgeous burger with its butter-glossed bun.
"Eat!
Eat!"
Kit ate faster than she could swallow, but forced it down anyway, desperate to be sated, tearful, a puppy at the teat. Crisp lettuce, creamy mayo, juicy rich burger, and fluffy bun to bind it all. She took a dozen fries, dragged them through ketchup, and stuffed them in her mouth. Salty, golden, the best single mouthful she had ever known. She ate it all and thumbed the plate until it shone. She drank her Coke in long draws. Sip, gulp, breathe. Sip, gulp, breathe. And watched the level drop below the ice until she could hear the sputter of her straw taking in air around the last drops of drink. With every vital swallow, she felt herself take shape. It was only now she had the wherewithal to look at the man sitting across from her with any attention. Taut, oiled skin stretched over beautiful bones. Straight, sepia-edged teeth. Minky brows pinched in amusement above eyes that burned blue. The whole arrangement of his features was so perfectly harmonious, she wished she could stop time and study them, run her fingers over their contours, commit them to memory. Manny salt and peppered his ketchup and dipped a runt fry.
"So, are you going to tell me who you're running from?"
"Here we go," she thought. Kit reflexively looked out the window. A westbound 18-wheeler might do if she needed a quick getaway. Stow away in the back of the cab while the driver wasn't looking. Hot day, windows were open. Trouble was, he'd probably overshoot Pecan Hollow. Better to get there on foot as planned. The big variable was Manny and his agenda. If he had one, was unclear. Would he let her go or try to turn her in?
"Actually, I'm going somewhere," she said.
She had to make him think there was someone waiting for her, that she would be missed.
"I have to meet my aunt. I was supposed to meet up with her, but stopped for food, and that's when you found me."
She cringed at the lameness of the lie.
"What about your parents? Anyone I can call?"
More questions she couldn't answer.
"No," she said, gauging his interest.
She couldn't tell yet if he was being helpful or trying to suss her out. Maybe he was the type to hold her for ransom. She nearly laughed at the thought of a moneyed couple pacing the halls of their fancy upholstered home, anxious to bring their darling girl home.
"Just my aunt. She'll be wondering where I am, but you shouldn't call her or you'll worry her even more."
Manny looked at her suspiciously, but said nothing more. The waitress dropped off the check and a monstrous, oozing banana split with two spoons. At the sight of it, Kit grew damp and queasy. Unaccustomed to the richness of the meal, her stomach revolted. She wiggled out of the booth and broke for the bathroom, slopping the floor with her sick on the way. Bent over the toilet, she vomited lavishly, what must have seemed like an improbable amount coming from such a small person. She looked at the mess she had made and peeped. "It's all wasted." She felt ashamed to see the splatter of her insides on the toilet bowl, the floor, her shoes. Manny touched her back. He must have followed her in. She tensed against it, half expecting him to shove her head in the water. But he held his warm, broad hand against her like a compress. And it dawned on her that he was not mad. He was there to comfort her. Her cries slowed. Her breath settled. He brushed the tangled dark hair away from her face and dabbed her chin with a coarse paper towel.
"I've seen roadkill look better than you."
He was teasing, intimately. She didn't smile back, but felt less afraid, It sounded like he cared. A woman who had been standing at the mirror cleared her throat pointedly. In one hand, she held a wand of lip gloss. With the other, she pinched her nostrils.
"I'm sorry, but that is just nasty," she said.
Manny pivoted on his knee in her direction, his head cocked.
"That isn't very nice, is it? She's just a little kid."
Was he standing up for her? Kit burned with a feeling that made her forget about the nausea and the mess and all of it.
"I guess so."
The woman, deep in her 30s, had rouged her cheeks so it looked like she had been whacked on either side of her face with a stick.
"You're not supposed to be in here, mister," she said.
She bit a glittered nail and smiled.
"I should scream."
Kit didn't like the empty way she was making a threat, her lips pouty, like those of a child.
"Why don't you be a sweetie and go scream for a mop and some rags?" he said to the woman.
She inserted the wand into its slim bottle, twirled it closed, and dropped it in her purse. Every gesture performed slowly, as if for an audience. She pressed her sticky lips together and walked toward the door, where she paused as if thinking of something to say, then closed the door behind her.
"You fucking slut,"
he added under his breath. Kit startled at the nastiness of what he said. The comment seemed so unlike the rest of what she'd experienced with this man. She wondered if she had heard him wrong.
"Let's get you cleaned up,"
he said, kindly now. He lowered the toilet cover with a square of paper and flushed.
"Don't mind her."
Kit nodded, shelving the flash of ugliness he'd just shown her. She wiped the tears and snot from her face and sniffed, detecting a pungent combination of vomit and body odor. She pinned her elbows to her ribs and hoped he couldn't smell her too.
"Will you come with me?"
he asked. She was so used to being bossed around or yelled at or physically handled, his asking struck her as a great kindness, and she did not refuse. She took his outstretched hand, a catcher's mitt that enveloped hers, never minding the mess they were leaving behind, and followed him out of the bathroom. Although the trip was short, Kit fought to stay awake in the Mustang, its throaty engine and bumpy ride like a lullaby. She noted the easy landmark of the towering cartoon Roadrunner which stood above the diner. She tracked their course, noting turns, exit signs, and any resources that would help her out should she need to take off on her own. They pulled up to a motel, a horizontal roadway in with an empty kidney-shaped pool and a half dozen trucks in the lot. Manny killed the engine and they got out. Kit trudged up the coarse, gravel-inlaid stairs and followed Manny along the flickering outdoor corridor into a chilly room.
"Home sweet home,"
he said, cheerful and a touch expectant, as if he hoped she would like it.
"You live here?"
she asked, taking in the thick turquoise curtains, the frayed brocade bedspreads, the brass hanging lamp. It was beautiful.
"Well, I roam a bit, I guess. Never did stay in one place too long."
"Me neither," she said, turning the dial on the space-age TV set.
"You're welcome to stay here until the morning, if you like."
He adjusted the air conditioner. Beads of humidity gathered around its vents.
"No pressure. I just thought you looked pretty beat. I suppose I can take you to your aunt tomorrow."
She tensed at the prospect of staying in his space. This man whom she'd just met, who seemed too good to be true. She had visions of being whacked across the head and thrown into the trunk of a car, dumped in an alley, or a lake. But she just didn't get that feeling from Manny. He had left his wallet and keys on the table, right by the door. Who did that? She could just snatch it and run away. He was nice, she thought. not the type. And besides, she was so tired. She couldn't imagine another night sleeping in the grass. The sound of insects crawling, the swish of coyotes nearby, the incessant threat of being seen and found and taken away.
"You can sleep by the door if it makes you more comfortable," he said, as if reading her mind. "I'll be on the floor by the bathroom. The bed's too lumpy for me anyhow," he said.
With the fingers of both hands, he raked his long hair back, and there it stayed, glued by she didn't know what. Wax, gel, its own grime. Suddenly aware of an urgent need to pee, she went wordlessly to the toilet, embarrassed to admit the errand. She shut the door and relieved herself as she always did, as fast as possible, never knowing when someone would bust in and hijack the bathroom. When she flushed, the paper took a slow orbit around the bowl, but the toilet didn't empty. She staved off panic at the thought. Of what? She wasn't sure. Him seeing her waste? She had already puked and nearly passed out. What did she care? He was no one to her. Still, there was no way she was leaving her stuff in there. She jiggled the toilet handle, then lifted the heavy lid with a scraping echo, as on a tomb. She fished around for the loose chain at the bottom of the tank and reattached it to the lever that lifted the plug. Outside, Manny was whistling some chirpy ditty. She made sure the door was locked and tested the flush. The toilet gurgled, swished, and swallowed every unwanted trace of her. Crisis resolved, she inspected Manny's things. Razor and shaving foam on the sink, a fresh tube of toothpaste and a pink toothbrush, 3 thin towels folded neatly in a stack, a damp wash rag hanging to dry on the side of the tub. Tidy as a church. No sour stench of many bodies. No furry grout. No goopy hair products and makeup clutter and loaded litter box wedged by the tub. She ran a finger along the smooth, shiny lip of the sink. She sighed a little resting sigh. For the first time since she left the Moshers, she saw her reflection in the mirror. "Wretched," she whispered. She had heard a social worker describe her once this way. Dark eyes, in color and regard, tangled hair to her shoulders that would be inches longer if she kept it brushed. Never owned a brush, wouldn't use it if she had. Dirt stenciled along her hairline and jaw, sooty smudges under her nostrils. Under her eye, a raw scar, kinky from her uneven stitches. She took off her shirt, her flat chest ashy blue against the dirty tan of her neck and arms. Skinny, ribby, with a belly slightly bulging. "Wretched," summed it up. "You look like a boy," she said as a matter of fact. Her expression had the vulnerability of someone who is trying hard to be invulnerable. A rap at the door. Kit dropped to the ground and covered herself with her shirt.
"Jesus H!"
"Easy," he said without opening the door. "Just making sure you didn't fall in. Make yourself at home. I'm gonna run get you a change of clothes."
"Fine,"
she called out, hoping to sound indifferent, though she was relieved she'd have the chance to bathe alone. She listened for the click of the door, the thud of his boots on the stairs, the rowdy start of the Mustang. It wasn't until the sound of the engine had faded that she turned on the faucet, stripped to her underpants, and sat in the tub as the water crept up over her till she was submerged in warmth. With a clean wash rag and a honey-colored puck of soap, she scrubbed her skin pink and prickly, washed her hair, and rinsed until it squeaked when she dragged her fingers through it, tugging at the snarls. She drained the murky pond and refilled with fresh water, just for the pleasure of it. but not before rechecking the lock on the door and bending the razor blade into a makeshift weapon, just in case. She wondered if the moshers were sweating that they'd lost her again, if they'd see punishment, or if someone would just cross them off some master list of eligible foster parents. Paul and Fran Mosher were different from her other families. They had vanity tans and coordinating billowy caftans and sometimes walked around au naturel. They had spent their savings traveling to Woodstock the year before and were desperate to tell you all about it. They were people who believed they deserved nice things, but never seemed to work hard enough to have their own. Paul was often involved in sensational business strategies that required him to purchase some volume of inventory at a deep discount, which he was never able to turn around. He would disappear at odd hours and return bleary-eyed and morose, at which point it was wise to avoid him. Fran stayed mostly at home. She did psychic readings for old women she met in the market, women who wanted to speak to their dead husbands or children or pets. Her favorite pastime was sunning herself on a towel on their little patch of grass, anointing herself with baby oil. The first time Kit had tried to run off, maybe a month before, she had gone 3 days without eating before she passed out in a cluster of bluebonnets. She had awoken in a shower curtain hospital cubicle, a bag of cold fluid dripping into her arm. She'd detubed herself and staggered toward the lit red exit sign at the end of the hall. She had made it as far as the elevator before being escorted back to the holding area where the other, mostly Spanish-speaking patients, sat awaiting treatment. Kit spent the night there on a cot among the sounds of the ill, in and out of sleep, and in the morning her social worker showed up none too glad to see her. She lay on the back seat of the woman's sedan as they drove back to her foster home, a prefab box house in a subdivision 40 miles west of Houston, indistinct from the other homes on Pine Oak Terrace, except for a collection of hanging stained glass in the windows. Peacocks, mermaids, and various scenes of psychedelia. Inside, it was a nauseating mix of pea soup shag carpeting, wood veneer paneled walls, and an ozone of cigarettes and hairspray. The tired rep from social services left Kit just inside the door with a final warning. Fran was away at a seminar for gifted persons, which left punishment to Paul, historically avoidant of conflict or even really acknowledging Kit's presence. That day, he beamed her square in the face with a dictionary, still wrapped in its plastic, that they had won in a sweepstakes. The impact split her cheek like a dropped tomato. He swooned when she bled so hard it inked the front of her shirt. Her face felt hot and numb.
"Shit, sorry, I didn't think it would hit you."
He floundered with a dish rag, dabbing it in the area of her face, but not daring to touch her.
"Should we get you to a doctor?"
"I'm not going back to the hospital. It's fine," she said, the blood pooling in the little reservoir at the base of her throat. Seeing the horrified look on Paul's toast-colored face, she decided to push it further. She found a sewing kit in the laundry room and returned to Paul, who was seated and bent over at the waist, drawing slow breaths. She pulled up a chair next to him, threaded a needle, and stitched up her cheek right there at the kitchen table. Her eyes watered reflexively, but it did not hurt.
"What the shit is wrong with you?"
he said and stumbled to the bathroom. She relished twisting the knife to his weakness. Maybe it was a fucked up thing to do, but this toughness was the only thing she liked about herself, the only scrap of leverage she had. It was more than toughness, though. For as long as she could remember, when her body was injured, it failed to register pain. So, Kit had to learn to look for signs of damage since she couldn't feel them. But it wasn't that she felt nothing. She could feel temperature, pressure, tingling, moisture, and she was hypersensitive to touch. If someone got near her, her skin goosed and she could feel their body heat. On the rare occasion someone had tried to touch her affectionately, it burned. A doctor had checked her out once after she had gone to school with a broken left arm and didn't realize it until she tried to pick up her book bag and it fell to the floor. The doctor kind of scratched his head and said,
"I knew you people were tough, but I've never seen anything like this."
His best guess at why she hadn't felt the break had been nerve damage. Then he put a cast on her and signed her discharge papers. A pretty resident who had been standing in the room lingered after the doctor left. She told Kit's foster parents to leave the room and asked Kit questions like, "Have you been hit?" and "How often?" and "Who takes care of you when you need help?" The resident said she had a hunch that this condition, this numbness, may have been on account of all the bad stuff Kit had been through, that she should see a psychologist to know for sure. She said the same thing to the parents and even wrote down the name of a psychologist in Houston, but they never followed through. They didn't have time or money to shuttle her to Houston just to talk to a shrink. Not that Kit was eager to get to the bottom of it either. She didn't see the use in fixing it. To do what? Make her feel pain again? She hoped it never went away, this special power. Manny knuckled, shave and a haircut, on the bathroom door and hung the shopping bag on the knob.
"Just a few things for you when you're ready,"
he said and turned on the television. Sounded like news. Artillery shells, chaos, the rhythmic thwack of helicopter blades, the war that had been dragging on as long as she had been alive. She felt sorry for those people getting shot and captured, their villages torched. She had never understood why the Americans were even in Vietnam. She slipped out her pruned hand and hooked the bag's handle with a finger while clutching a towel at her throat with the other, then shut and locked the door again. The fact he had gotten her clothes at all was beyond expectation. Nevertheless, she hoped he had not bought her some girly nonsense for which she had no use. She was relieved to see inside the bag some t-shirts, striped and plain, some shorts, a pack of underwear, and a simple pair of blue jeans. She poked her legs into the denim, kicking a little to work her toes through the holes, and tugged a shirt over her wet head. She stepped out into the room. "This'll be fine," she said with a cautious glance toward Manny. "Thank you."
"They look big, but the lady said they would shrink in the laundry."
He must have seen the stiff denim gaping at her waist and piling up at the tops of her feet. Kit couldn't be sure, but from the way he leaned forward and smiled, eyebrows high and hopeful, it seemed that he wanted her to like them.
"Never had these before," she said.
"What, jeans?"
he said.
"New clothes."
When he looked at her, so interested and kind, Kit wished she had not revealed this to him. She thought it best to share as little as possible. Manny reached toward her, and she took a two-step back. He showed her his palms.
"Sorry about that. Okay, no sudden moves. Can I get these for you?"
He gestured toward the price tags dangling from the collar and belt loop. She stayed put and removed the tags herself with two swift yanks.
"Roll up the ankles for now. We can find a place to wash them tomorrow."
She folded the cuffs twice over.
"On our way to my aunt's house?"
"You betcha."
Manny laid a blanket on the floor and stretched out alongside the bed, fully dressed, his jean jacket draped across his chest. He fell asleep quickly and easily just moments after the lights went out. Kit stayed up for an hour or more to make sure he was asleep. And after running her escape route in her head until it felt automatic, until she felt that the risk was manageable enough. She finally succumbed to the exhaustion of the day, razor blade shiv in hand. Chapter 9. The next day, Kit awoke to the chugging and hum of the air conditioner and a bar of light across her eyes from the gap in the curtains. By some miracle, she had slept all night without waking. As she pushed herself to sit up in bed, she wondered again if the Moshers had sent anyone to look for her, or even noticed she was missing. She slid onto the tufted carpet and went to see if Manny was still sleeping. But the space between the bed and the bathroom was empty. The blanket squarely folded and pillow back in its place on the bed. Kit scanned for traces of him, anxious for a sign that he hadn't left her. She looked in the bathroom, but his things were gone. Panic inched up her chest and into her throat. She pulled out some drawers and found a King James Bible and a matchbook. Pressing down a swell of panic, she checked the closet again and swatted the wire hangers in furious protest. Then she noticed a length of black cloth on a high shelf underneath a spare pillow. Balancing on the chair, she strained to reach a corner of the fabric. The chair tipped and gave her the extra quarter inch she needed to reveal the objects underneath. A Remington 12 gauge and a box of shells. The gun's oily barrel gleamed. Her breath came back. He would not have left his gun behind. There was no money in the bathroom, but she did find Manny's toiletry bag, neatly zipped and hanging from a hook on the door, hidden from view in her initial desperate search. She slid her arm under the bed and collected an origami $5 bill and a couple of nickels. Kit was hungry again and decided to return to the cafe where Manny had taken her last night. She walked out of the room, leaving a slip of paper in the door to keep it from latching. The sun shone more gently than it had the previous days. A cooled breeze tossed her hair around and tickled her cheeks as she followed the route they had taken the night before in reverse. Right turn onto the feeder road for about a half mile, then another right at the Denny's onto the big road and keep walking toward the cartoon Roadrunner. She had nearly reached the cafe when she saw a coyote hesitating at the shoulder of the road. It looked around, not noticing Kit, and took a tentative step forward, then recoiled as a car sped past. She wondered what the animal was doing out in the middle of the day. When there were no cars visible, the coyote ventured to the middle of the asphalt, pausing there before looking back and continuing on her way. Up from a dip in the road, an 18-wheeler appeared. Even Kit hadn't heard it coming with the wind blowing. The truck didn't brake or honk. Maybe he didn't see her. Maybe it wouldn't have mattered. It charged a straight course and clipped the coyote on her hip, sending her spinning through the air. Kit gasped. The coyote skidded and rolled and came to a stop on the opposite shoulder of the main road. She was still moving slightly, but could not get up to walk. Then, she lifted her head in the direction she'd come from, whining metallically like a stopping train. She seemed to be calling for something. She dropped back on the road, having exhausted all her strength. Her belly heaved rapidly and then stopped altogether. Kit approached, a sickly flutter in her gut. From the culvert, she heard a raspy chorus of yips. She followed the sound and found four coyote pups. One was licking himself. Two nipped and tumbled with each other. The last whimpered as he struggled to climb the steep ditch up to the road to follow his mother. Kit gripped the one climbing toward the road by his scruff and pulled him to her chest. She scratched his head and he nipped at her playfully, his new teeth sharp. She stroked the down on his belly, and the pup slowly relaxed in her arms. She couldn't believe how trusting he was. Kit began to fret, unsure what to do about the motherless pups. She felt faint. She wanted to scoop them all up, put them in a pouch, and keep them near. Bottle feed them in her lap. They would fight each other for the bottle until they were drowsy. Bring squirrels as soon as they were hungry for meat. But where would they stay? She didn't even know where she would be tonight, what she would eat. She couldn't save them all. The pup in her arms wriggled and mewed, then dozed off in the crook of her elbow. She closed her eyes and bowed her head, waiting for the guilt to pass.
"You can't have that thing in here," the middle-aged waitress said, looking down through her glasses at Kit and the wriggling pup that pawed at her chest.
"His mama's dead," she said, and pointed to the lump on the road. The waitress, Maud, according to her nameplate, squinted and shaded her eyes, then looked back at the two of them, deciding what to do. She glanced at the register where the balding manager in a green vest stood pecking at a calculator.
"As long as it's quiet, y'all can stay. But once it starts yapping, you're out of here."
Kit nodded.
"And I swear to Jesus, if he makes a duty, I will pick you both up by the scruff and toss you out myself."
Maud touched her bouffant, as if to make sure nothing had mussed it during the excitement.
"Now, what can I get you, sweetheart?"
With the pup nestled between her thighs, snuffling and whimpering from time to time, but keeping quiet enough, Kit sawed into a stack of pancakes half a foot tall, buttered and syruped to saturation. She alternated bites of bacon and cakes, and then got wise and tucked a piece of bacon between each pancake and the next.
"I think I remember you from yesterday," Maud said, sliding in the booth across from her and placing the bill on the table. "You look like you haven't had a bite in days."
"I'm just built like this," Kit said through a sticky mouthful. The waitress looked her over, then down at the pup. He was beginning to wiggle and yip. Kit figured he was hungry. She took a straw full of milk like a dropper, her thumb over one end, and fed the coyote. He lapped it up and chomped at the end of the straw, massaging his gums.
"See, he's quiet now. He just needed something to eat."
Maud didn't look convinced. Kit wadded forkfuls of pancakes and finished the last of her bacon, determined to get her meal before something went wrong.
"You know, sweetie, you can't keep a wild animal like that. He's cute now, but he'll turn on you soon enough. When I was your age, I used to rescue every one of God's creatures that passed through our yard."
The waitress held out her forearms and rotated them to show the scant design of scars, thin and pearly.
"Some friendlier than others, but most of them died anyway, and it broke my heart in two every single time. I think maybe they would have been better off just fending for themselves, letting nature decide what became of them instead of me."
Kit couldn't respond. All she could think was it couldn't be wrong to love a thing. It couldn't.
"So where's your daddy?"
Kit shrugged, amused by the thought of Manny being her daddy.
"You don't know?"
Maud said gravely.
"Well, that's not good."
Seeing the alarmed look on the waitress's face, Kit said,
"I mean, he just went to pick up some stuff for me. He'll be right back."
Kit started to worry about Manny again. Where had he gone? And why not tell her he was leaving? It bothered her to feel tethered to someone she didn't even know. For now, she just needed to keep the waitress from raising flags.
"I almost forgot. He asked me to order him some pecan pie and a glass of milk."
She checked her cash and looked at the total on the bill, already more than she had brought with her. The waitress sucked her teeth skeptically, stood up, and turned on the heels of her white sneakers toward the kitchen. Just as Kit was about to slip under the table and take off for the motel, she heard boots scuff up to the table and a voice say,
"You ate without me?"
Kit looked up to see Manny, smiling, cool as a mint. It took all her strength to hide how relieved she was to see him.
She was real hungry, sir,
Maud said, accusation on her brow, as she walked toward them with the pie and a frothy glass of milk.
You're telling me.
Manny ribbed Kit and winked at the waitress.
She's eating me out of house and home.
Maud shifted her weight onto one hip and crossed her arms, evaluating the pair. Kit looked down at the pup and wished the waitress would take her skeptical eyebrows and go away.
Who's this little fella?
Manny said, scratching the pup under the chin.
Is he for me?
Another waitress swept past Maud and handed her a tray full of dirty dishes.
Can you finish bussin' six for me, hon?
The waitress said, then whispered,
I gotta run for a maxi pad.
Maud's new burden seemed to take precedence, and she left the two with an updated check and a pair of green and red peppermints.
Y'all take care now, hear?
Kit sighed and pulled the kicking pup under her chin.
Where were you?
She asked.
Why? Did you miss me?
He asked. She looked up quickly and met his smiling eyes, so blue against his dark lashes.
No, she said. I was just making sure I still had a ride to my aunt's.
Cute little guy,
he said.
I don't know shit about animals. You got plans to take care of him?
I'm thinking about it.
You think your aunt will be all right with him?
He said aunt like she was a fictional character.
I don't know. Probably not. The waitress said they turn mean when they grow up.
Huh,
he said, finishing off the last sticky bite of pie. He wiped his mouth with a napkin.
You can't deny an animal its nature.
They walked back to the motel in silence, the noon sun high and hot. The coyote followed them in short sprints, stopping after each run to gnaw an itch, bite at a flower, or sit down to rest. When they approached the carcass of the pup's mother, Kit scooped him up and held him to her chest. When he thrashed and cried against her arms, she felt ill thinking that he had recognized his mother's passing scent, was trying to get back to her.
Look, no pressure, Manny said. But do you want another day to think about what you're going to do with the pup? I don't have to be anywhere. Why don't you sleep on it, and I can still take you where you need to go tomorrow. He seems awful sweet on you.
She said nothing at first, then nodded, relieved, yet burdened with the thought of making a decision at all. When they got back to the room, she made a bed for the pup in the bathtub with a pillow and filled a clean ashtray with water for him to drink.
I gotta step out again for a few hours. You gonna be okay?
Manny tossed the remote on the bed.
Nothing on but soaps, I don't think. Sorry.
She rolled the pup on his back and scratched his chin.
We'll be fine.
That night, alone in the motel room, Kit lay awake with thoughts of the other coyotes in the ditch. They must be starving by now, she figured, imagining them climbing out of their den, stumbling up the bank to the road, following the scent of their mother. The pup had been whining intermittently all night, hungry, thirsty, lonesome. She wanted to hold him and feed him something warm and sweet, would tap her vein to nourish him if she thought that would help. But she knew she wasn't enough, and every sound he uttered ratcheted up her guilt, made her feel selfish for trying to keep something she couldn't care for. All she had ever known were people who'd taken her in and realized she was too much. But then, how could she expect complete strangers to take care of her when her own mother hadn't wanted her? She remembered hearing about how some animal mothers, when they would smell something wrong with one of their young, maybe weakness or poor constitution, would eat the weaklings. Others would simply leave them to predators and the elements. When she heard this, She couldn't help but think that her mother must have sensed something with Kit. A congenital wrong that no amount of love could right. She thought she had been loved once. There had been a family, the Foyts, she lived with when she was 7. They seemed perfect. Little house with a yard, a 10-year-old boy named Teddy, and 3-year-old girl they called Shell. Miss Rhonda, the mother, worked during the day, but at night, after bath time, she would scruffle Kit's hair with a towel, comb the rats out, and braid it tightly. She'd read stories to her, as many as Kit wanted, and perform a different voice for each character. Kit had loved those nights, when Miss Rhonda would tell her about her days growing up on a farm in Oklahoma, how her parents were Bible thumpers, and how she'd run away as soon as she was old enough to work on her own. Kit just listened, mute, because she was afraid if she opened her mouth, she would tell Miss Rhonda how stupid she had been for leaving a perfectly good family. Kit would never say anything to make her cross. Miss Rhonda hugged her, good, long, tight hugs that felt like sugar to Kit. None of the other parents had hugged her, hardly anyone at all, and Kit got to where she needed a hug as soon as she got home. A few months into her stay, Mr. Foyt left with all his clothes and never came back. To keep the family afloat, Miss Rhonda took an extra job. When she came home, she would kick open the door, drop the keys and her purse on the floor, and disappear into her room to sleep until her next shift. Kit never saw Miss Rhonda cry about her husband, but after he left, she lost her sweetness and stopped spending time with Kit. The loss of Miss Rhonda's affection was devastating. Kit missed Miss Rhonda so much she stopped sleeping at night and could scarcely keep herself awake during the day. The school nurse diagnosed Kit with mono and ordered her home from school. She lay on her mattress for a week, too tired and too sad to move. It was as if a horse had rolled onto her and died. She would have rather been a wild child, eating garbage and hunting ugly animals no one would miss. Even if it meant she'd die young, of hunger or violently by the tooth of some near-city predator, she'd take that any day over the feeling of being ignored. One day, while Kit was still in bed, a social worker came and explained that Mrs. Foyt was no longer able to take care of her. Her hurt bloomed anew at the thought of leaving. She wrapped her arms around her shins and pressed her eyes to her knees until she saw bright white and yellow splashes and the heaviness and the heartache dimmed to a bearable numbness. And for the first time, Kit discovered how to kill her feelings. How sweet it was to master this one small slice of her life. How powerful she felt. The social worker waited in the car while Miss Rhonda helped Kit pack up her things, which were few, and saw her out. She hugged Kit goodbye, but by this point, Kit had detached. She couldn't want Miss Rhonda anymore. As they drove away, she watched the house shrink in the distance, swallowed up by the pretty trees lining the streets. It hurt to think of Miss Rhonda and the little taste of loving that was given and taken so abruptly. As she lay there in the motel, the pup whining and clicking at the tub, Kit pushed at her eyes and swallowed the ice cube sadness in her throat. She was embarrassed to think how much she had relied on Miss Rhonda, hadn't even seen the end coming. Maybe that was when she'd learned that being loved was a fairy tale, and the best she could hope for was making it on her own. Kit left the bed, slipped on her jeans, and cracked the bathroom door. The coyote pup had finally passed out, kicked a limp hind leg in his sleep. She lifted him by the loose sleeve of skin at the back of his neck, held him at her belly with one hand, and tucked her shirt into her pants with the other, making a little pouch. As quietly as she could, she carried the chair to the closet pulled the shotgun from the shelf, and stuffed 4 shells in her pockets. She knew how to kill a thing, how to follow the creature as it moved with the barrel of her gun, take aim, and pull for a clean, quick death. A shotgun like this had more recoil, so she'd have to hold it tight against her shoulder. And even then, she knew it would knock her back a step or two. She walked the quarter mile up the road and took a grim survey of the surroundings. The mother's carcass lay where it had landed, no doubt riddled with nascent maggots and rot. But there were only 2 pups left and no sign of the third. Most likely he had become a meal for some passing hawk. My babies, she thought. And again, she wanted to scoop them up and lay them on soft bedding and give them everything they needed. She choked on her tears and lay the pup she'd been holding with the others. The numbing washed over her. A tingle at her cheeks that sank and spread outward, fanning across her body and through her organs until the suffocating sadness seemed locked behind some door, the chinks stuffed tight. She stood up, gun raised, and aimed at the silver mass nestled among the weeds. She realized she must look deranged out here on the highway, holding a loaded weapon at a litter of pups. She heard someone walk up behind her. She whipped around and saw Manny, just a few feet away, aiming a revolver at her. She froze. She could try to get a shot off, but the gun was so heavy. She'd be dead before she could even take aim. She squeezed her eyes shut.
"Use that and you'll blast them to tatters," he said.
Her heart was pumping so fast she could barely understand him. When he started walking toward her, she heaved the shotgun to her shoulder. Manny was not afraid.
"Don't shoot me now," he said,
easily disarmed her, and laid her weapon in the grass.
"We've only just begun."
He passed the revolver to Kit and clasped her hands between his, warming them. She suddenly felt the weight of her feet on the ground, could hear the breath move through her, and on her skin, the cool of deep night. She felt less alone, that there was one other soul in this world that saw things as she did.
"Here," he said, "I'll hold it steady. You fire."
With that, she steered the gun toward the pup she had carried with her all day, the one she'd so hoped to save. She'd take him first, because he was the hardest, and because she didn't want him to be the last of his kin to go. He had curled up on top of the head of his sister and slept, little belly rising and falling with his breath. She said no goodbye. She squeezed the trigger, but it wasn't enough to fire. Her eyes shut, and she felt Manny gently correct her aim. She pulled as hard as she could and felt the gun swing up and back in recoil, steadied by Manny's sure grip. The crack of gunfire sang in her ears well after the shot went off. She heard the other pups react, harsh squeals of fright and confusion, and quickly took aim and fired twice, this time eyes open to make sure she did it right. The next morning, they packed up the few things they had. Manny tossed his bag on the back seat of the Mustang and lay the shotgun on the floor.
"Off to Auntie Eleanor, right?"
He looked to her for confirmation, and she nodded and stared out the window, squirmy under his gaze. He fished a map out of the glove compartment and made a show of unfolding and refolding the edges around the route to Pecan Hollow.
"Let's see, okay. Here we are right now, just outside Navasota."
He tapped their location on the map.
"So, where's this Aunt Ellie supposed to be?"
he asked. She pointed to the town in tiny print.
"Okay then, vamanos," he said,
and eased the car into gear. She felt heavy from last night. She knew she had done right by killing those pups. Killing them had been an act of mercy. No food, no mother to look after them. Nothing good ahead of them, she thought. They would have died anyway, from hunger or from predators. She had been driven by a sense of duty. But even the act of justifying her choice struck her as wrong. Now, guilt and sadness crept in, almost imperceptibly, an odorless poison. She wondered what Manny thought of her and was still trying to figure out why he had helped her finish them off. Maybe he had been punishing her, rubbing her face in the mess of her own decision. It didn't seem like him, but then, who was he after all? He seemed friendly, caring in the little ways he would think of her. He gave her space, but she never felt ignored. He seemed interested, curious, and yet he was patient enough to let her be known at her own pace. The humid air, hot already, rolled over her like nausea. She debated what her next move was going to be. On the one hand, she was getting close to what she thought she had always wanted. Family. A home. How many times had she daydreamed about what it would be like to wake up knowing she'd never have to leave, never want to? That something deeper kept her there. Not an arbitrary placement by an overworked system, but something connected to who she was, in her blood. Still, Eleanor was no one to her, not yet. They were kin, but that hadn't been enough for her aunt to take her when she was a newborn. Why did she think her aunt would want her now? Manny rolled onto the shoulder of the road and slowed to a stop. Kit looked around. To their right, a horse farm for sale. To their left, cars speeding past on the interstate.
Hey! Can you listen here?
He rapped her on the head with his knuckle.
I need to tell you something important.
She looked at him out of the side of her eye.
Last night, the coyote pups,
he said. She had hoped they wouldn't have to talk about this.
That was pretty messed up, don't you think?
He asked. I don't know, she said, focused on a crack in the windshield the size of a bullet hole. A grasshopper bounded through her window and landed on her, its claws clinging to her skin through her t-shirt. Manny reached over and flicked the insect from her shoulder back through the window.
Well, I think it must have taken guts.
She exhaled a little breath she had been holding.
You see, the point is...
He turned toward her.
You are special. I suspected it when I first caught you swiping my lunch like a little bandit. You have a wildness about you. Not that shallow, anxious thing most people have. You're strong, Kit. You're fearless. You can do things others can't.
Special. This sounded like a good thing, but she couldn't make sense of how it had anything to do with her. It felt strange to hear him talking about her with enthusiasm. She only vaguely had a concept of herself at all. Life had been a series of capture, punishment, and escape. If anything, she had always been punished for being herself, for being a leech, a reject, for taking up space. She wasn't special. She wasn't anybody. She was formless, liquid, slipping out of sight or absorbing into her background. She was wretched.
You wouldn't think it, but we're the same,
he went on.
I've been alone all my life, and so have you. Don't you feel a bit different than other people?
Something tweaked inside her. A lump formed in her throat.
I think I found you for a reason. Do you understand?
She looked down at her lap and took a few steadying breaths. His words were sweet beyond anything she had dared hope for. This swelling warmth, this desire to please, this urge to be a part of something important. It felt like the answer to everything. She didn't need some old aunt who hadn't bothered to look for her, who probably didn't even want her. She needed a friend. Kit got out of the car and kicked through the high grasses and sat on a salt lick by a feed trough. Horses had come here to eat, but not in a long time. Grass had reclaimed the places worn by many hooves. The lumps of manure turned to powder underfoot. Carefully, she pulled the baggie from her pocket and removed the note inside. Kit read to herself the pretty cursive, carefully drawn. "Take this child and care for her. She will be something." She folded the note, bagged it, and replaced it in her pocket. In a bashful voice, she said aloud, "She will be something special." She got back in the car, and with all the courage she could summon, she spoke, nearly faint with the stress of asking for something she wanted so dearly. "Could I just stay with you instead?" She forced herself to look at him. He smiled.
"Kiddo, that's what I was getting at,"
he said, and he held out his hand. She high-fived him as hard as she could, splitting with joy. Manny put his arm across the back seat and one-handed the car to merge with the fleet of vehicles speeding away, his tires kicking up gravel and smoke.